TFM.
Fun will now commence.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Journey, our dedicated Star Trek Voyager podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, when I see you talk into that mic, my pleasure will be greater than yours. You don't know how to respond to that, right?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, I'm sorry if that makes you uncomfortable. I just spent the weekend on Sicaris, and their enthusiasm for pleasure really rubs off on you.
Wow, so many jokes. Let's get to the show, Chris, before we get ourselves into trouble.
I think that's a good idea. Yes, everyone, we're going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Voyager today with episode 9 of season 1. This is Prime Factors, and here is a quick rundown of the story. Having heard stories about Voyager, a ship of aliens from another part of the galaxy, lost in a world so far from home, the Sicarians decide to assist. Drawing in Voyager with a distress signal, their leader, Gath, offers a helping hand. He ain't got a clue how to get them out, but he does think he knows what they need. A little pleasure. When Janeway accepts the offer of shore leave for the crew, Harry quickly finds a girl who's hot for stories, and then finds himself miles and miles from nowhere on the planet Alastria, 40,000 light years away. It turns out the Sicarians have a spatial trajector that can zip them around the quadrant, and with everyone on the planet hot for stories, the crew might just be able to trade all the Federation's literature for a quick ride home. So, Matthew, looks like we're in the Pleasure Dome this week. On this planet filled with people who just can't get enough stories, what are your first thoughts on the Sicarians themselves? Who, by the way, were supposed to be, along with the Kazon and the Vidians, one of three antagonists for the Voyager crew in season one, but they're kind of like the Voyager Ferengi in that the first outing pretty much nixed the plans for them to be baddies.
Yeah, I mean, I think they just don't turn out to be as pleasurable as possible. This is the thing. I'm going to spoil this right up front. I actually think this is a fantastic episode of the series. And partly because the discussion and the exploration of this idea of a society that has basically become a planet of hedonists who look specifically and only for how to give themselves pleasure. And that is not just the way you're thinking, get your minds out of the gutter, people. It is in every single facet of the word, whether it's food or reading a good story, as we'll talk about in a minute, or the experience of being on a planet and seeing a beautiful vista, or, I mean, and of course, you know, physical pleasures. And so they run the gamut of what we would consider and the word would culminate in as hedonism, right? And I think that's actually a pretty fascinating idea that you would have a planet like this. And what I think is also really fascinating too is that the way in which the episode is actually able to kind of dig underneath the surface, in that this seems like, wouldn't this be just a great way to live, right? And what we find is that there is kind of a seedy underbelly of hedonism and the pursuit of pleasure that can cause people to possibly not actually be that pleasurable to be around. And so because really what that turns into is the very thing to which, you know, George Lucas talked about with Star Wars, right? Which is the Sith are all about selfishness and that idea of getting whatever they can for themselves, and only themselves matter. And that's kind of what we see here with the Sicarians. And I find that to actually be a really interesting idea then for Voyager to run across these people and then be faced with an incredibly kind of taxing and perilous decision for themselves as to how they are going to live out the principles they say they actually believe in. Mm-hmm. And will they actually follow them when, you know, push comes to shove, where the, you know, the, I don't know, the warp bubble meets the space-time continuum. And, you know, that's the Star Trek version of rubber meets the road, I guess. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. The producers all seem to feel that this episode is quite a good one. As you said, you feel it's a very good episode of the series. Michael Piller mentioned that he did not feel the Sicarians came off well. He regretted the casting of Gath. But what I'm trying to think of myself is, I see how the Kazon work as antagonists, and the Vidians are far more interesting than the Kazon because you can actually feel sympathetic for the Vidians. The Sicarians, yeah. I'm trying to picture if they were to encounter the Sicarians here and there throughout the course of the series, particularly the first season, second season, I'm wondering what those encounters might be like. Could you really build on this concept? Because as a single story, it's a very interesting concept for a race, and if it had been executed a bit better, maybe, you know, Piller and others on the production team would have felt better about the results of it. But, and they set it up with this spatial trajectory, allowing them to jump anywhere in the quadrant. Gath actually mentions we can go anywhere mm-hmm. in this quadrant. That would have made it very easy, because one issue I have with the Kazon as the early part of the series goes on is that somehow the Kazon seem to always keep up with Voyager, even though Voyager can go much faster than their ships, and it
right.
you know, doesn't yeah. really make sense. Whereas here with the Sicarians, it would have made perfect sense for them to be able to jump wherever they want to go, and you're going to run into them. But I'm not sure that it would have worked.
Right.
It sounds like one of those ideas that you have that looks really good on paper, but once you actually see it play out on screen, you realize that, yeah, mm-hmm. I think this is a one-off
yeah.
alien race and probably not a big baddie for us.
Well, and I think, you know, I think Michael Piller actually, I hate to say it, but I think he's wrong here, because I think the portrayal of Gath is exactly what you need, which is, at first, mm-hmm. this guy seems to be great. And then as you get to know him further and further, what you realize is that he's not, because he is a person who only cares about his own pleasure and the pleasure, I guess, that he could bring his people, but really just about his own pleasure, right? Mm-hmm. And in that, I think it's perfectly portrayed, because that's the type of character that this person, I think, would actually be. I think all of these people would actually be like this. Is it, in some ways, like, the whole discussion that we've had many times with Deep Space Nine, right, where the question became, it's easy to live a certain way in paradise, but what happens when paradise is threatened and or taken away?
Mm-hmm.
And well, the very same thing
talks about, right?
I mean, yes,
he's talking
exactly.
about Federation or Starfleet officers
yes.
and all. Yeah.
Yes. And I think, you know, it's conversations he has with Odo, right, that, mm-hmm. that really, you know, kind of bring this up. But I think that's kind of the discussion that we actually get with this planet, right? And so I think it really, I think, yes, you they wanted them to be a bad that you could kind of continue to run into. But I think, and this is the hardest part with Voyager, and they knew this coming in, and they did this to themselves, and so they have nobody else but themselves to blame. But it's, we're in a part of the galaxy where we know nothing or no one.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have to create alien races every week that we're going to run into. And creating ones that you want to continue to run into, that's difficult. You know, I think about the way in which, you know, yes, the original series gave us the Romulans and the Klingons, right? Really the only two races that we spend more than a couple of episodes on. Everybody else, mm-hmm. we might see them here and there, but we don't spend any time with Andorians or Tellarites or any, you know, we don't do that. We barely even send spend time with Vulcans, you know?
We have a killer dinner party with them, though.
It's true. Very, absolutely. Be careful. You never know what's going to happen. And then, you know, TNG, right? They also were kind of running into this because, well, they didn't really want to lean into previous villains in the first few seasons. Mm-hmm. You know, they lean a little bit more into the Romulans than the original series did. But
oh yeah.
So again, you did this to yourself, and so therefore, to find that kind of like lightning in a bottle alien race that's going to work is very difficult to do. And mm-hmm. these were clearly not going to be them. And partly because I think it works best as this standalone story where they don't want to mess with Voyager anymore because they're not warriors. They're not going to come after us because we won't give them stories or whatever. And we can't, in the end, use their technology anyway. So it becomes a moot point. Yeah. I don't know how else we that would have come off.
I can just see Voyager receives a distress call from some other planet, and they're like, we're being attacked. They're downloading all of our literature. Can you please help us?
Exactly. They're stealing all of our movies. And so
our books are gone.
You know, we didn't even ask if they had holodecks. You know, we could have given them all sorts of programs. But Quark would have had a field day there. So I really think that this comes down to, and it might be the place where the episode maybe is a little bit weaker than it should be, and mm-hmm. partly because I think they probably needed to focus just slightly more mm-hmm. on the discussion and the kind of portrayal of a pleasure planet, mm-hmm. you know, one that's fully devoted to pleasure. You know, people go to Ryza, which is, you know, a holiday planet, a pleasure planet. But most people don't live there, right? They go there for a vacation, and then they go away. These people basically live on 24/7, 365 Ryza. And what that's like and who that creates as a society, I think is an incredibly interesting discussion. And I think it's a salient discussion for the world in which we live, because I think we live in a world that is rife with people who are so driven by pleasure and so averse to hardship that creates a lot of the problems that we kind of have in our world, because people don't know what to actually do when they actually hit hardship. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the whole discussion. Like, I feel like if this episode was written today, that might be more of the type of thing
we're discussing. Yeah, it might be written today. Yeah. But I think in this story, like, I think the extent to which we see the pleasure planet and the fact that these people just care about pleasurable experiences, I think it's enough for this individual story. So when I was asking, well, what would you do with the Sicarians? Mm-hmm. I am thinking more about if they had used them repeatedly,
right?
What would you do with them? In this story, I think it's enough to make the story work, because really the two key points here are about the Prime Directive. So as Janeway says in the episode, it's the first time that they're on the other side of the fence here, where Starfleet is very accustomed to citing the Prime Directive when someone asks for help and saying, I wish we could, but our rules say we can't. And that's all fine when you're the one who's upholding a principle and you're not the one who's in need. But when you're on the other side of that, it feels really different. And here, they're in a situation where someone has something that could potentially really, really help them. But the canon of laws says we cannot help you. So that's one part of the key discussion.
Yeah.
And then the other part is something that Seska talks about a lot, which is what's more important, our principles or getting home? And what's the primary mission? So Janeway's primary mission that has been set is to get the ship home. So once you do that, other people on the crew, even Tuvok, start to interpret that as, okay, well, if that's our primary mission, what do we need to do to achieve that mission. So these things, the prime directive canon of laws and principles versus getting home, is really the core of the story. And I think that the portrayal of the Sicarians and their pursuit of pleasure is strong enough here to put the sides against one another and then allow a lot of internal discussion on Voyager about how they should approach the situation.
No, I agree with that. And I think that what kind of fascinates me about the whole idea of the other side of the Prime Directive is that Sicarians, this technology seems to be so dependent on the way in which their planet is created and has been created and just is. And so their technology seems to be something that most, it seems like almost any warp capable species really wouldn't be able to utilize, because warp generators are pretty much kind of standard throughout most ships, I guess, unless you're Romulans and then you're using, you know, micro black holes, which who knows how that works.
Which sounds never really dangerous, explained. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But it looks so cool, and you know.
It does. Yeah. So I think that is fascinating. And really, there is a great discussion, and I think they do a very good job of this in the episode, of everybody wrestling with, what is their priority? Is our priority to get home, or is our priority to uphold our values as Starfleet officers, even though half the people in this ship, or a third of these people in this ship, aren't, you know, really Starfleet officers and haven't been? They've just been, like, made to be. And so I thought that one of the things that really makes this such a great episode is that we actually kind of deal with some of the ramifications of having my key members and Starfleet officers here working together, and the conundrum that that creates when you put these two groups together, and the priorities of these two groups are not always going to align. And so that's one of the places where this episode really stands out, because it truly is one of the first places and one of the few places in season one where we actually utilize the differences of the Maquis members and the Starfleet members to create some you know, drama and tension. And I think it's actually done really well. And so that's one of the reasons I think I respond to the episode, because it actually kind of lives up to some of the promise that the original episode set up, you know, in creating. So,
yeah. And there's another layer to that, which is that we see character development for B'Elanna, because Seska says over and over, that doesn't sound like you. That doesn't sound like you. And so you're seeing someone who, now, of course, B'Elanna is a little bit different than some of the Maquis in that she did spend time at the Academy.
Right.
But coming into the encounter with Voyager at the beginning of the series, she's very much thinking like a Maquis. And then you see here how she, even before she gets dressed down by Janeway at the end, she's already really changing how she thinks about things. And she's buying into these Starfleet principles a lot, whereas Seska's not. And so I think they do a good job here. And this is where I think Seska really shines in this episode as a resource, as a character, because they're able to create this contrast between people who had previously been crewmates on the Maquis ship.
Well, and I think, too, a lot of the questions that, you know, you ask, I mean, Lieutenant Carey, you know, he's like, I've got a wife and a kid, and I don't want to never see them again. I don't want to get home and they're grown up and moved on because they thought I was dead. You know, I just think that there's something really well done about that, because that is the ramifications of the decision that Janeway made, which is, it's one of the things that really just drives this episode, right? Is, again, we are dealing with the ramifications of the choice that Janeway made for all of these people involved. And I think, you know, that is excellent storytelling, right? Like that's the storytelling that we kind of want from this series. And what I also appreciate about this is because it's really kind of taking then very seriously the premise of Voyager in the first place. So one of the things we've talked about. They're at this planet for a good reason, which is, yes, everybody needs some rest. And then two, being here creates a ethical dilemma, which is a hallmark of the Star Trek storytelling for our characters and for the story. But it's the thing that actually allows us to get to know the characters better through the dilemma, which really create the hallmark of a good Star Trek story, right? It's not just something to preach at us. Really what it is, it's a storytelling structure that allows us to actually understand the character motivations behind the people we're watching on screen. And that's the stuff that makes for good television in general.
Yeah, one of the questions raised at the beginning of the series is, can the Starfleet crew and the Maquis crew come together and be one crew? And then at the beginning of this episode, they're joking around with Harry and Janeway sitting there with Tuvok and says, it's finally happening, they're coming together. But what's interesting as the story goes on is that, well, first of all, up to this point, and this is a common observation about the first season of Voyager, is that very quickly, out of the gate, that tension kind of goes away and we get into kind of typical Star Trek stories. But here it comes back, but it comes back in a more textured way than you would expect, because it isn't simply, as we're discussing here, the Starfleet side and the Maquis side being able to come together, but you have Kerry and even Tuvok from the Starfleet side looking at the situation not in the way you would expect from a typical Starfleet crew. And then you've got, again, B'Elanna from what was originally the Maquis side looking at it in a way that's not the Maquis way. So the crews are starting to come together, but not in the simple this side versus this side way that I think was the premise of the concept of the show from the beginning, which is a lot more interesting.
Well, the beauty of this is the whole idea of the crews coming together is that this is an incredibly it's unexpected way for them to find commonality.
Right.
Yeah. Again, the fact that Kerry and Torres and Seska are all agreeing, and even Tom and Harry are agreeing that there's agreement between these characters, which is the microcosm them and we're supposed to take as the macro of the entire ship. That is exactly what Janeway wants, but it's happening in a way she could have never expected, or maybe she might not necessarily want, right? And yet, that's kind of the beauty of the story. And so I think it's again, it really goes to show that by creating this one-off villain of the Sakaarans has given the opportunity for us to grow the characters together in a way that only takes, 42 minutes. And that is actually pretty impressive writing because it feels real. It doesn't feel forced, right? Even the kind of the beginning, because there's been this budding kind of friendship between Harry and B'Elanna as like she's the older sister and he's the younger brother type of thing.
Younger brother.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, that comes off with his blowing it with one of the Delaney sisters, which nobody's surprised about. And that whole thing creates that, and you can tell, again, this is something, they've been on the ship for months now, and so this stuff has been brewing. And then this moment of kind of one more, I hate to use the word like, I'll say trial, right? This trial of ethics pulls them together in a way they could have never expected. And so again, I just really like that. I think it's one of those things as I was watching the episode, because I don't quite remember many of these episodes verbatim. I was like, oh, this is good. This is good. And the whole time I was just kind of really leaning into the story and very much enjoying what they were doing. And I think in part of that is kind of what I said before. It really feels as though this episode truly leaned into one of the promises of the series, mm-hmm. and it found a way to actually deliver that in a way that felt very organic, very real, and very visceral then mm-hmm. for these characters.
Well, you said it pulls people together, kind of like Wesley Crusher's superconductor magnet from the Dauphine, right? Because that prop,
you had to bring that up.
Well, that prop yeah. is actually used in this episode as the spatial trajectory. So,
yes, yes.
The connection.
Yeah, they just had it lying around, you yeah. know, might as well.
Yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. Going back to the technology, as I'm getting close to the end, I'm thinking, again, if I'm doing a first watch through, look at it from that perspective. They start talking about, as you mentioned, how this technology works, and it relies on the fact that Sicaris as a planet has a 20-kilometer thick layer of tetrahedral quartz, and that's what generates the energy source to allow the trajector to work. Okay, so that part's fine. I mean, that's a case where, because of the properties of a particular planet, mm-hmm. a civilization might be able to create a technology that other people cannot create. But I'm also wondering, and I even went back to see, is it explained and I missed it? And I don't think so. When they actually use it and they travel to somewhere like Alastria, 40,000 light years away, how do they get back? How are they able to actually trigger? Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't seem to be set on a timer, because Udonna wanted to
yeah.
hang out as long as possible with Harry
yeah.
for stories and other things. So how do they get back? So I'm thinking, well, how does this work? And then they get into the whole thing about anti-neutrinos, and so it would never be mm-hmm. compatible with Federation technology, and it would only be useful on or near the planet.
Right.
So I thought, okay, well, that makes sense, and it is an interesting point to talk about how technologies are not all compatible, because so often in Star Trek, I mean, if you go back to the original series, you know, they steal the Romulan cloaking device and
yeah, exactly.
install the Enterprise,
right? In.
You know,
yeah.
and every ship, no matter which species developed the ship, the airlocks always seem to work together, right? Mm-hmm. They can dock.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we were talking on the other side of the quadrant before we started recording about Picard, the series Picard, and I mentioned there's actually a connection to the first season of Picard and this episode, and that is on the artifact, the Borg cube that the Romulans are working on. Picard goes there and he meets Hugh, and Hugh is able to transport Picard and Soji to Nepenthe to safety. Mm-hmm. And the way he does that is by using a Sicarian trajector. The artifact has a trajector on it because apparently the Borg assimilated Sicarians and then they modified the trajector so it no longer needed the quartz on the planet to operate. And that's how the Borg are able to actually jump through
right.
to places. So there's this little connection yeah. to that, which yeah. I found
that's interesting.
That's interesting.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah. Maybe that's just because that season kind of lives nowhere in my mind, but
it's up on the shelf behind you there, right?
Yeah. Actually, it's the only season of Picard I don't own.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I have the other two, but I don't have that one.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. I would have rationalized that as that they have a communicator that they just chirp and be like, hey, I want to come home, and then they pull you home that seems to be the only way that would honestly make sense.
Yeah. So. Well, if it were me, if I were doing the costume design, I would have Udonna wearing like a little quartz pendant on a necklace and some quartz earrings.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then
yeah,
that's how she would get back. And don't worry.
It
doesn't do yeah. any brain damage. Don't worry. You know, having all that dangling
sure,
around your head
sure,
as you transport
sure. mm-hmm. yeah.
40,000
yeah,
light
years. I'm pretty sure that's got to be the case.
Totally safe.
Totally safe. I mean, sure. Chris, you know what? I'm sure it's fine. So we got to talk about Harry and this beautiful alien woman who whisks him away alone. And she is very interested in him. And, you know, they are feeling the summer breeze makes me feel fine. blowing through the jasmine in my mind.
I mean, it's the quartz in her mind.
Yeah,
actually,
no, they're feeling the euphoric winds of this planet and everything. And the moment she mentions that how they transported and where they are, Harry's got a one-track mind, and it ain't on that.
He's like, I can do this complicated math on the fly.
Exactly.
It's 2. Whatever billion miles from your sun to your planet, and we're 40,000 miles away. Yeah, like show
off. It was hysterical. Like this whole thing, just it was. You know, they had set up, right, that Harry is just a doof when it comes to love, he couldn't wait 5 minutes. He had to go and talk to the captain, which I just thought was pretty hysterical. And
the funny thing is too that when they arrive back on Sicaris, just before that, Janeway had almost kissed Gath, and she's like stopped. And what's going on here? She's kind of in that situation, somewhat similar to what Harry was in. But Harry's the one that runs in. It's like, Captain, they've got this amazing technology. And just kind of like watching Janeway sit there, you could again see the contrast between these two people and how they're.
Yeah, Gath was not excited to be,
Gath's like, God damn trajectory.
You know, he's.
Why is everyone so. Do you know how many times I've almost kissed and then it's fallen apart because of the trajectory?
Oh my gosh.
God, you're done. I told you, stop taking people to Alastria.
This captain's beautiful. And anyway, Harry doesn't just ruin his own chances at love. He also ruins Janeway's. All kidding aside, though, you know, the other thing that we get here is these people's love of stories, which them desperately seeking stories to entertain them, I think is interesting, right? And in many ways, I guess it is kind of a subtle commentary on this idea. And goodness, isn't this even more salient again today than it was then, about people being so enraptured with shows, movies, social media,
and all, because that requires effort to read, Matthew.
Yes, it's true. But all of these things that can allow us to kind of get sucked in and get lost outside the real world and into a universe of our own making. And I find that to be really interesting, because Gaff's response to Janeway is the same response that we see now. The moment that you pull somebody out of their supposed reality that they've created and block their pleasure, they become angry. It's the first thing. Everywhere. It is why we see so much anger, is because people do not understand that life is not just about doing whatever you want, whenever you want, and nobody else getting in your way. That's not how life has worked ever. And it's only, you know, within the last, I think, 40, 50 years, and especially the last 20, where people have really started to believe that all of life can be only what I create it to be. And anybody that gets in the way of that should be destroyed. And my first response to anybody who breaks that, you know, bubble, they should be destroyed. I should be really angry at them. I mean, that's fascinating. And so that's one of the places where I found this episode to. This is the very first episode of Voyager so far where I have truly found it to be incredibly thought-provoking in the way that the best original series episodes are, the best TNG episodes are, the best Deep Space Nine episodes are. This is the first one that I think is actually that way, and mainly because the more you start to dig into the episode and the way this race is created, the more interesting and seemingly relevant the story actually becomes. Mm-hmm. And that again, it's great writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Janeway tells Gath, I was just trying to illustrate the difference between us. And he says, oh, I don't enjoy being judged like this. It's very upsetting, not at all pleasurable. And doesn't that sound like so much of online discourse these days? Like, if anyone
sounds
hears,
like everyone in the world these days.
If someone hears something that isn't exactly what they think or how they view a situation, they get very upset, right? Like, you can't illustrate differences anymore. So, you know, like, diving into stories and in our own world, people being so loving to get lost in TV shows or movies or things. Like, I get it on one level, because when so much bad stuff is happening in the world around you and you feel so helpless to have any influence over it, it is understandable to want to retreat into some world that at least you find pleasurable. But at the same time, it's sort of a self-fulfilling, well, it's not a prophecy, but the situation, like, you're also fueling the situation by disengaging, right? Because then you allow the people who are changing the world or destroying the world as you want it to be to do their thing, because the disconnect, like I'm just saying here, you know, Gath doesn't want to talk to Janeway because it's not pleasurable. And therefore, things just continue to get worse and worse.
Yep, 100%. I mean, it really is, you know, kind of, it's just one of those things where I love the way you said it. What he says sounds like something you hear every single day on every single forum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just forums, and it's not just online, but you hear people say it in real life. And you're just like, this, you know, again, there's this sense of reality creation. Mm-hmm. And the moment that you block my reality, my first response is, I'm just going to take you out, man. Cause like, this is, you know, how dare you? And I find that to be, it's obviously sad, but it's interesting that the Voyager writers had actually pinpointed this so much earlier than, you know, we're kind of dealing with it now, which I find to be really fascinating.
Yeah, because the situation that we're in today's world, where this was written, my memory, living in the United States at the time, it was not like this, right? This is where, you know, I mean, you and I, again, you know, we have quite different worldviews, but we have a lot more in common than we have not in common. And it's easy for us to talk to each other about things. And that's how it used to always be, right? I had plenty of friends I talked to all the time back at the time this was written like that. But today, it feels like a rarity to be able to do that. So, well, okay. So the other point we should talk about here as we get close to the end is the end of the story, Tuvok's betrayal of Janeway, and the crew is working on this idea themselves, some of the crew, Seska, B'Elanna, Kerry, about how they're going to trade the Federation library for this technology. And Tuvok's onto them and they don't know it. But then he comes in and he makes the decision that he's going to go make the trade himself. And behind the scenes, I've read there was a lot of discussion. Tim Russ wanted, they already did make modifications based on his feedback about the character of Tuvok, but he wanted to change even more, but there wasn't time because they're writing close to the time they need to shoot the episode. But the producers also had their own views. And so Tim Russ's view was that Tuvok makes the decision because it's the logical thing to do. And he wanted to clarify that he was protecting Janeway from a brewing mutiny. And the producers, I know Jerry Taylor's mentioned this, that like their thinking seemed to actually be a lot more in line with what Tim Russ was thinking as well. Maybe he didn't feel that way at the time. But I'm curious what you think about it, because from the very first time I saw this episode, I've always read this episode as Tuvok made this decision to spare Janeway from having to make the decision herself. And he was trying to protect her both as his friend and as his captain, while also trying to help bring the crew together in the mission of getting home. Because if it were just simply like, it's the prime directive. These are our principles, and we're never, ever going to do anything that violates those, then you're definitely going to lose a lot of the crew at some point, because you're never going to get home if you don't bend the rules. So what was your reading of why Tuvok did this?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like that the episode, to me, did a good job of actually explaining himself to Janeway. You know, I thought that it made a lot of sense as to why he would do this. And a big part of it, because I do think that his reading of his friend is not all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there almost is a part of Catherine who desires to be able to do that, to just take this technology and run, you know, to quote Steve Miller Band, take the technology and run, instead of the money. and so I really do think that that does seem to be true. And so in that, I think that logic is correct. And then wanting to protect his friend in that as well, I think it makes a lot of sense. And so I think it would have been interesting to actually discuss the idea of, I was also worried that there might be a mutiny, and it was better for me to handle this than for the crew to devolve with all the work that we put in to get to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would have been actually really interesting. I do think, to me, it still makes as much sense as it needs to. And what I actually kind of like about it is that Janeway is actually able to clearly kind of hit on a point which is really powerful, which is, hey, logic, you can utilize that to do anything. And if you're not tempering that logic with something else, you're going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. You can logic your way into the worst of things, right? In fact, you can logic your way into the worst of atrocities.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that that Janeway really makes that point for her friend. Mm-hmm. And we see it play out. And I think it's really well done. So in that sense, that's the thing I find most interesting, because it allows us to kind of discuss something with the Vulcan idea of life that actually is kind of a huge problem. And we've mm-hmm. never really dealt with very well on the show, any of the shows, honestly, even Enterprise, right? We never truly dealt with the fact that logic is all well and good, but the only person who's ever expressed that logic is not enough is Spock, where, you know, he talks about mm-hmm. logic is only the beginning of wisdom, and that's the truer statement. And it's interesting, because what we get here is that there is this very clear demarcation line between Tuvok and Spock. He's not gotten to that spot yet. Yeah. And maybe Spock was actually helped in that because he was part human.
Well, that's
and
the
maybe
key.
It was easier for him to recognize. And so this shows how much more difficult than it is for true Vulcans who mm-hmm. maybe have completed the Kolinar to actually reach that type of level.
Yeah, well, that's the key. I think only Spock could deliver that line and come to that conclusion, because he's half human, and also because of the influence of Kirk and Bones on him over the years. And the other Vulcans that we see are typically full Vulcans, and I don't think they're going to reach that conclusion.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So as far as the mutiny goes, I think it works okay, because as the viewers, we see that this mutiny is brewing. It's not a mutiny, but you can see that it could lead to that, right? If Janeway were to stick to this course of only our principles matter. So the thing that Tim Russ was talking about there, I think it comes through in the episode, but Janeway's not aware of it. So as you say, if they could have discussed it and Tuvok had explained to Janeway what's going on behind the scenes, it could have helped her better understand why he did it.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing that was changed, and I don't know what the original speech was, but Tim Russ has said that originally Janeway's speech to him at the end of the episode was a lot harsher and a lot stronger, and that was changed. And I am glad that was changed, because the way that it comes off in the final cut of the episode, I think works really well for the relationship between Janeway mm-hmm. and Tuvok. And it echoes back to earlier in the episode where they're sitting together and Tuvok is helping her figure out what to do, because in both cases, and it so much relies on Kate Mulgrew's mastery of being able to play these moments both through her voice and her body language and her facial expressions, you feel the years of friendship between these two people. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, I think a very, very harsh dressing down of Tuvok at the end by Janeway would not have felt natural. I don't think that's how she would actually react to someone who has sort of been her counsel for so many years. So whatever influence Tim Russ had in getting that aspect of the story changed, and the producers listening to those concerns and all, I think was important for the story to close successfully as it did.
Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the interesting parts of that is, and this is where I actually like it better than them kind of going, full hog, really upset, yelling kind of thing. I think what it does for the episode is that it allows us to see Tuvok is not all wrong mm-hmm. in his assessment.
Yeah.
And that is the thing I think I find the most interesting. I think Janeway really does realize that there is a truth to what her friend has said. And in some ways, she has to deal with that internally, right? And so how could she necessarily be super upset at her friend for actually picking up the internal struggle that she's been feeling? And so that's the thing I think that really makes the conversation that they have feel so much more legitimate and mm-hmm. real, because it again, this is one of those places where I think the episode does such a great job of creating a lot more nuance than just making it easy, right? And it makes Janeway then a very, I think, nuanced and conflicted character, because I do think that this episode makes Janeway have to deal with the ramifications of what she has been saying to her crew, which is, yeah, we're going to be a star for the crew, but we're going to get home. And mm-hmm. all she's talked about is getting home. And it'll be interesting then, as we watch the rest of the season and the rest of the show, how does this impact the character moving forward? Does Janeway become somebody who seems to be slightly less obsessed maybe with getting home, and a little bit more dedicated then to the Starfleet ideal? Is there any changes? Is there not any change? So I think that's a really interesting question then, to be able to have the episode ask us. I'm kind of excited then to be able to deal with the rest of the series then in that way.
Well, any final thoughts, and what's your rating for this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no surprise. Everybody can kind of hear that this is an episode that I have responded to really well. And I think that it's a great episode of the show. I think the writers really took this into a place we didn't expect. And it's a hard episode for everybody involved, which I like. I think the episode asks tough questions of the characters, and it makes them deal with those things. And I like that. It's one of the things that, for us, Chris, our show that we both kind of love in Star Trek and has had a huge impact on us as fans is Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And one of the mm-hmm. reasons for that is for the sometimes the ambiguity that there is. Sometimes the way in which it makes us kind of have to think a little bit deeper and a little bit harder about questions than we might have on just the surface. And so therefore, I'm going to give this I'm just going to do it, Chris. I'm going to actually give this maybe my first 5 out of 5 almost kisses for Harry Kim. And so, because I really do think that this episode deserves the accolades. I think it's the first, actually, I would say, really great episode of Star Trek Voyager. That's my opinion, and I'm going to stick to it.
Great, great. Yeah, I agree. It's an excellent episode. I think it hits at the core of Star Trek very well. And yeah, probably is, if not the first, one of just a few, maybe along with some stuff in Caretaker so far in the first season, that really has the kind of nuance and asks the type of questions that are key to Star Trek principles and so forth that I really enjoy. And I like, actually, overall, the design, look, and feel of the Sicarians, even though I don't think they would have worked as a recurring alien. But the thing about Voyager, if you're a costume designer or a makeup artist, it must have been a wonderful show to work on, because every week you're getting to do something new. And the little loops in the back of their hair in this one.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, as I often do with aliens in Star Trek, how impractical that must be. I imagine everyone on this planet gets up early in the morning to do their hair and get their little rings in place. But it does give a distinct look to the Sicarians. I like that. I also wanted to mention that this is an episode, you know, here and there in Star Trek, there are a few episodes outside of the original series where many of the stories were written by very famous science fiction writers. But later on, we have episodes here and there that are written by people who Star Trek fans best know as authors of novels. And this is one of those stories which was co-written David R. George III.
I meant to mention that. Yeah. Thank you for doing that. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I forgot, because I saw that in the credits. I was like, oh dang, that's great. I totally forgot.
Yeah, so this is one of those. So I think he did a great job on this one, along with Eric A. Stillwell, who is the co-writer of this story itself. Now, the teleplay was, they didn't get to do the teleplay, but they did the story. And David has said that the ultimate story is pretty close to their original concept. Once they got rid of the very original idea, which is that the Sicarians, maybe the name would have been different, but the alien race would have been the aliens who sent Gary Seven to Earth in the original series.
That would have been fascinating.
Right. And Michael Piller didn't want to have such a close tie to the original series. So they...
Dang you, Michael Piller!
Well, I think he's right on that one. Like, I actually think the story works better by not having that distracting element.
No, I agree.
To the discussion. But that was the original idea. But no, I think the story turned out great. So I'm going to give this one 9 slices of pecan pie.
Nice.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Prime Factors. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose To the Journey, and that will come to us by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is trekfm. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not bending the rules to meet the needs of the moment, where can people find you?
You can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. You can also, of course, find me here on the network outside all the Star Trek talk in the 602 Club, where we are having a great time at a bar talking about all of those franchises we love outside of Star Trek. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network with 2 shows. One's called Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week, as well as Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out how to get back to those woods of euphoria, where can people find you?
The woods of euphoria. It sounds like a scent of like Old Spice antiperspirant or something like that. the woods of Euphoria.
Well, yeah. How do you know it isn't?
It might be. When I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all those shows with you, of course. You can find me in many episodes in the back catalog across lots of shows. And you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything else we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your help. So thank you to everyone who is supporting us right now. Well, Matthew, we're not going to be in a state of shock next time, but we might be in a state of flux.
Well, Chris, that sounds interesting and maybe a little bit scary and slightly unnerving. But why don't we set course for home?